You're listening to the Archaeology Podcast Network.
Hello out there in archaeology podcast land. This is Dr. Alan Garfinkel. I'm the president and founder of the California Rock Art Foundation. And what we do is we identify, evaluate, manage, and conserve rock art both in Alta California and in Baja California. We conduct field trips, we have trainings, exercise, we do research, and in every way possible, we try to preserve, protect, and coordinate treasures of Alta and Baja California rock art, of which there are many and diverse. We also work closely with Native Americans and partner with them to recognize and protect sacred sites. So for more info about the fabulous California Rock Art Foundation, you can go to carockart.org. Also, I'm open to give me a call, 805-312-2261. We would welcome sponsorship or underwriting, helping us to defray the costs of our podcasts, and also membership in California Rock Art Foundation. And of course, donations, since we are a 501c3 nonprofit scientific and educational corporation. God bless everyone out there in podcast land.
You're listening to the Rock Art Podcast with Dr. Alan Garfinkel, a podcast about all things rock art. Send us your suggestions.
Hello and welcome to the Rock Art Podcast, episode 43, with Dr. Alan Garfinkel and myself, Chris Webster. Today, I talked to Dr. Garfinkel about his experiences filming the documentary for the History Channel about Skinwalker Ranch in Utah. All right, welcome to the show, everybody. Alan, how's it going?
Going well. It's wonderful to be back with you, Chris. It's always an exciting adventure each week when we try to deep dive into the mysteries of rock art and indigenous cosmology and all things relating to the fields of archaeology, anthropology, shamanism, rock art, et cetera, et cetera.
That's right. All right. Well, we mentioned a few episodes ago that you were part of a television production on Skinwalker Ranch out in Utah. So we're going to spend the hour talking about that because we really just grazed the surface of not only how you get involved in that, but what the heck is Skinwalker Ranch and what's a Skinwalker and all these things. It sounds like something out of Game of Thrones on HBO. So we're going to have to...
it probably is, but right. this will be one of the more interesting and I would imagine thought-provoking and if not somewhat controversial. So we'll give you the behind-the-scenes look into what Skinwalker Ranch and what it's like to be an on-air guest scholar.
All right, so let's dive into this. We're obviously going to talk about what Skinwalker Ranch is in a little bit, but I want to go like timeline-wise. Did you know what Skinwalker Ranch was prior to being contacted about this documentary?
Not a bit. I'd never heard of Skinwalker Ranch, don't know anything about it.
Okay.
When they asked me about it, they called me because another very well-known, recognized expert in rock art declined their invitation to do the guest scholar spot. And they told me who that was. I don't know if I should mention it or not, but anyways, it's someone that everyone who follows rock art would know.
Okay.
And he said, no, I'm getting too old to do this stuff. And what you're asking me to do is not worth my time and effort. And it sounds like it could potentially be, dangerous.
Yeah. Okay.
And so that sort of, you know, bothered me a bit to hear
that.
Only
for a minute though.
Well, only for a minute. Yes. But it bothered me. And I said, interesting. I said, well, I'm available. I'm interested in send me the details. Mm-hmm. And so began our interaction with basically someone who books the guest scholars on the number two show, the second most watched show on the History Channel. And wow. I understand that there's something like 2 million people that see each episode of the show, which is you know, mind-boggling.
That's almost as many people as listen to this podcast. So you're coming up in the world.
Exactly. You know, if you can do the Rock Guard podcast, Alan, you can do the Skinwalker Ranch show.
That's so what I'm talking about.
I had them watch Talking Stone, the documentary film that I did with Paul Goldsmith that was aired on the on PBS. Mm-hmm. And they were very impressed with that. And then we talked several times, and they understood my, you know, the way I speak and the kinds of repartee that you and I communicate on a regular basis. And they said, you know, I think you're exactly what this show could want and deserve. I think you'd be really good for it. So then they invited me to consider the participation.
So you decided to do it. What kind of research or preparation did you do prior to going out to Skinwalker Ranch?
Zero.
did they send you anything?
Yes. They had a liability form.
Yeah. Yeah. That's all they sent you.
That was the one thing I read.
Yeah.
And the liability form gave me almost a cardiac arrest. It basically said that you could die or be dismembered if you participated, and they were not responsible for anything that happens to you.
Wow.
And nice. I'm not exaggerating.
Yeah. All right. Well, that sounds fun. So you signed that.
No. So then I said, I don't think I'm going to sign this. I think this is not acceptable. I've never seen any sort of liability form that is this egregious and radical. You know, you're going to pay me $500, big deal. Mm-hmm. And you want me to travel to Utah, and you'll pay my trip, you'll pay my lodging, you'll feed me. But for $500 for, you know, for an on-air thing, I don't know if that's enough.
Yeah.
You know, to make it worth my while. They said, well, how much do you need? I says, well, give me $1,000, I'll do it. and they said, fine.
So let me get this straight. The release gives you practically cardiac arrest. It is horrific. It is basically releasing them of all liability. And you're like, you know what? My life is worth way more than $500. Let's call it $1,000.
Exactly. Exactly. I said, if I'm going to die, right, I'm going to at least have shown them that he wouldn't do it for 500, but he doubled it for $1,000. And sorry to say, he lost his life.
Wow.
But they tried to reassure me that, you know, all this was just mumbo jumbo. They had to do it into this document and da 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 da. I said, well, you know, I've heard it's the History Channel, and you've obviously got a lot of infrastructure and a lot of people that watch this show. And I know you've got some notable talent that has been attracted to it. Why don't I give it a shot? I said, okay, I've signed up. You tell me when we're going.
Mm-hmm.
So we went back and forth and back and forth. And it was about 6 months ago, maybe 7 months ago, that they said, well, we're ready to go. We'll send you the plane tickets. You'll stay at this hotel. You know, once you get there, you get settled in, we'll pick you up and get you out here and plan on spending the whole day, about 10 hours out there. Mm-hmm. And then we'll bring you back and everything will be copacetic. And I said, fine.
So a surprisingly short time between actually filming in the field and releasing it live to the world. Cause that was only, like you said, it was released a few weeks ago.
Yeah.
And almost a month ago. And so that was like six months or less.
Yes.
Yeah. 6 months. That's running it real tight. What if that didn't work? Do they have a plan B?
No. I think they just go, you know, and try and fill the void and continue in this interesting adventure. So,
man, see, that's why I stick with podcasting, because if we have a guest bail on us or we can't get one scheduled for one reason or another because schedules are tight, we just have a conversation and we make it work. But you can't do that on a TV show. Nobody wants to see me just talk about nothing.
Exactly.
Yeah.
So they have a whole realm of people that are working, a bevy of scholars and experts that are there already, but no, and they wouldn't, you know, if they just talked about themselves or did stuff by themselves, it would not be an interesting show, of course.
Right.
So,
right.
So,
Okay.
So I did do a little bit of background on the kinds of rock art that were there in the vicinity. It was in Utah. It's near the Barrier Canyon. It's near Fremont style rock art and all of that and much more. But I was familiar with that anyways. So that didn't seem to be extremely relevant. And it's near McConkie Ranch, which is a big rock art place as well.
I've been there.
So all of that and much more. And I said, okay, you know, I didn't want to bias myself by knowing too much or reading about it, etc. I wanted to just get a first impression and just be authentic and real as though I was discovering it for the first time. And I would tell them basically what I thought about the nature of their suggestions and questions. How about that? Yeah.
Yeah. Let's talk about McConkie Ranch real quick, because that's such an interesting place. I worked on a project in Vernal, Utah. A bunch of us went up there, and it's a privately owned ranch that you just basically drop some money in the thing at the front as like a donation to maintain the trails and stuff. And it is, you walk through the trail and it is some of the most striking rock art that I've ever seen. Just like this carved into the sandstone, full body anthropomorphs that are just enormous with with like shields and all kinds of stuff. Man, it is so crazy.
And that is really literally maybe a mile or two away from this Skinwalker Ranch.
Nice.
So it's right there.
Okay. So let's talk about Skinwalker Ranch a little bit then to kind of set the stage here. McConkie Ranch, like I mentioned, is a privately owned thing. Is Skinwalker Ranch also privately owned, and can people get access to it?
It's completely privately owned by a multi-billionaire.
Jeez. All right.
He has his own helicopter pad.
Yeah, of course.
And he rides, and he paid, I think, millions for it. And it's locked up, gated, secure, 24/7. They have state-of-the-art electronics all over the ranch. The place is bulletproof. There's the security guard packing heat, many actually, and they protect the ranch with diligence. Mm-hmm. They have a couple that lives there. One's an anthropologist, etc., and one's another professional, and they live there on premises, protecting the ranch. Also, you know, they have security guards that are there, professionals, several. And, you know, they're wearing the Black Ops whole look, and they've got you protected, and they've got the area surveilled electronically all over the ranch.
Wow, that's crazy. All right. Well, let's talk in the end of this segment here a little about you getting out there. They fly you into Salt Lake City?
Flew me into Salt Lake City, but then they flew me to somewhere closer. I think I had to. I believe I rented a car, and then I had to drive and drive and drive till I got to, you know, that location where you talked about. And then I got my hotel room.
Okay. And then you know, here's, so you get on site.
Where I was. Yep. So to get on site, I took the rental car myself, and they had me follow them there. And then when you get to the gate, needless to say, it's locked, and they have, you know, the people, they open it up, and then you park, I think outside the gate. And then they put you in this shuttle service, this little machine that they run around with, and get you out there. And then they give you a mini tour of just sort of the core facility. They have a 24/7 sort of whole, you know, what would you call it? State-of-the-art technology, digital technology that allows you to view every part of that ranch electronically in color on an enormous screen.
Jeez.
Yeah. And the people that they've got in there have PhDs, and they're physicists and astrophysicists and astronomers and every other kind of expert you can, engineers, geologists. They have them all on site.
Wow. That's
there.
Crazy.
Yeah. So you get there and you talk to them. They introduce themselves to you. And then you find that there is 20 people that have cameras and various other mechanical devices that will be following you around when you visit any part of the ranch.
Jeez.
And they'll be filming you and asking you questions as you walk the ranch.
Okay, then. Yeah. So. That sounds pretty intense. Well, let's go ahead and take a break, and we will come back and talk about the day of filming and how that went. We'll be back in a minute. Welcome back to episode 43 of the Rock Hard Podcast, and I am interviewing Alan about his time filming the documentary for the History Channel about Skinwalker Ranch in Utah. So the end of segment one, you've arrived on site, heavy security, you're ready to go, you're ready to start filming. So did they just point a camera at you and say, start talking, and they do the editing from there? Or how did this whole start off?
That's basically what they did. They said, we've got some places to take you and want to show you the facilities. And, you know, one of the facilities was hundreds of thousands of dollars were spent on equipment and surveillance information and technology, digital videography in color, instantaneous downloads all over the ranch. You know, just every part of that ranch was being surveilled. And so they said they really wanted to speak with me. They thought they had some interesting features or elements of a landscape, and they didn't want to influence me by telling me much more about it, but they would take me on a foot tour out to this place and get my insights and reflections. So that's what we did after I was professionally mic'd and, you know, and all of these cameras were looking at me constantly. As I said, we had about 20 people constantly moving around me with at least three or four different cameras at different angles as I tried to walk up drainages and not fall on my ass. and that's what was going on.
Now, with that many cameras on you, that's presumably to prevent taking like multiple takes and things like that, to have you repeat yourself because they want the initial reactions of things.
Right, right. But they did do that. They said, okay.
I'm sure.
You know, that was good. Now go back again and walk up that ridge again. Or, you know, answer that question again with, you know, just do it again.
Once more with feeling?
Once more with feeling, right. So we walked up this drainage and that drainage. And they finally really were focused on one specific area. And that was a prominent hill that was one of the highest hills or landforms on the entire ranch. And it gave you a spectacular view of the entire landscape. It was unbelievable. And on the top of that hill, lo and behold, was a geoglyph.
Okay.
And it was Aboriginal. They had sort of plopped up the sands at the top of it, and there was a shrine, like a rock cairn at the top of it. And then surrounding it was a serpentining, you know, circular abstract element made of rocks, which I've seen before. So that was interesting. Right? So there was that. And then as I began to look at the landscape, I noticed that the land forms that I was seeing looked like snakes. And one sort of met in one face, and there was another one meeting at the other face, and a drainage came down in the middle of them, like two snakes' heads and then the snake bodies. And I've seen that before. It's form of basalt, and the natural proclivities of basalt, of lava, are to form these kind of streams or curvilinear meanders. And there they were. So I pointed that out. And I said, well, you know, if you look at this landscape context, you've got the anthropomorphized elements right here of serpents right on the landscape. And then I said, okay, here's the central pivot, a shrine that you have on this prominence. And then you have, of course, this circular element that surrounds it. And that is obviously some sort of a central nexus or power spot that is being emphasized by this rock feature. They said, that's fairly rather interesting. Nice to know. And then they said, well, what about this? I said, what about what? He says, well, this is, can you see anything on this rock? I says, yes, it's a petroglyph. The more I looked at it, they said, yeah, it looks like another snake here. It's got a serpentine, you know, look here, and it's got the curvilinear meanders, and you see you've got a head-like phenomenon here, and it's very, very ancient. It's been revarnished and repatinated over the many, centuries and millennia, but you can still see it. And that's a nice added element. So they said, well, what does it mean? And I said, well, you're asking the right person. And they said, well, you know, why is that? I said, well, I've just come from extensive studies of such features, you know, in the Great Basin and the Desert West. And I'm writing a book on this and an article on this and all in all. And I sort of study the serpent and these circular meanders as what's called indexical animals. And they go, what the hell is that? Mm-hmm. And I said, well, you know, indigenous, prehistoric, aboriginal people, native people have a habit of identifying key predators, sort of top line animals, and those become shamanistic ancestor beings. They said, what does that mean? I said, well, in their cosmology, there's, you know, sort of a layered universe. Okay. Well, the topmost is the sky, and the middle is sort of the surface of the earth, and there's an underworld. Okay. And the underworld is often guarded by serpents.
Okay.
And certainly the rattlesnake or the what have you, a snake-like phenomenon, is part of this, and they serve as metaphoric beings. They are the guardians of the underworld, and as well, they're liminal creatures. What's a liminal? Well, a liminal means it lives in both worlds. It lives in the terrestrial world and in the underworld.
Right.
So, okay. So what does that mean? Well, it means that this area is a powerful area. It's a magical area. It's a supernatural area. And most likely it's an area in which one has access to a portal or a nexus, and that this portal connects the, you know, terrestrial conventional world with the supernatural. They said, oh, that's fantastic. That's exactly what we wanted to hear.
Yeah.
I said, okay, that's interesting. Well, then they showed me another part of the landscape, and there was a circular rock, natural, that was sort of drilled by the native people. And if you look in that eye hole of that drill and you put your eye there, it looks right at the end of that landform. And that area is in essence right where the sun would set, probably on the winter solstice or some other, you know, important, the equinox or something. And so there looks like there's almost an archaeo-astronomical element or alignment to this rock art, this place, which is common as well. So
okay.
You've got archaeoastronomy, you've got mythology, sacred narrative, you have geoglyph, you have all that and much more. And it's all kind of intertwined into this interesting place that is a power spot, and one that it sort of rings or feels as though it's a nexus for a connection that the native people would have with illustrating or understanding how they conceptualize the universe and their religious theology.
Okay.
Okay. So
yeah,
they weren't really big on it or interested in this. They wanted to know about, you know, what does this have to do with the supernatural? That's what they were all about.
So let's back up a second here.
Yeah.
They must have done some kind of research to know about Skinwalker Ranch. And when they got there, they must have had some knowledge here. So is somebody leading this?
Skinwalker Ranch has been on the radar of some of the most supernatural incidents kind of for decades. It's considered one of those places where you see UFOs. They've done studies of the ground and found that there's, you know, elevated elements of radioactivity. They've had cattle mutilations, you know, that are done in such a way that it's impossible to have done, where they, you know, they extract the eyeballs and they do a linear thing where, you know, and no other animals will touch the animal again. So it's something's gone on there that's supernatural. Mm-hmm. They've had floating little, you know, silvery objects that they've photographed and filmed, these balls of light that you see. Other people have seen these supernatural animals that they appear to hear growls and roars and other things like
that. Okay. But I guess my point is, these are TV producers, right? Now, obviously,
TV producers, but the people that I'm talking to, they're the people that are specialists on geology, engineering, astrophysics, and they have committed to doing this project to study to see if they can possibly investigate the nature of the doings there and make some sense out of it, to demonstrate what sort of supernatural phenomenon are occurring at the ranch, and do they have validity, and can we scientifically understand them?
Okay. There's somebody behind the scenes kind of prompting you, these guys helping prompt you with what they want to know, getting your opinion on things, and they're just filming the whole thing, and then they cut it together at the end for a nice little package.
Right. I spent 10 hours.
Yeah.
Count them, 10 hours, full-time, constantly moving, constantly being asked questions, sitting down, getting up, walking around, going back, going forward, doing the after shots, everything that they wanted.
And now, seven months ago in Utah, I mean, it couldn't have been warm.
Yeah, right. Exactly. So it was pretty hot. I was wearing a shmata on my head.
And, yeah, I'm sure.
And trying to, you know, avoid anything catastrophic. And everyone always asks, well, what happened? What happened? Did you see anything supernatural? I said, you know, not really. I didn't see anything out of the ordinary, but there is one thing that happened that was really weird. And they said, what is it? I said, you know, I had my phone in my back pocket and it didn't fall out. I didn't do anything differently. But when I opened up my phone, the entire glass was cracked and it was a brand new glass that I had installed.
Wow.
And they said, yes, that's common. We know about the cracked smartphones. Happens all the time out here.
Jeez.
So that was the weird thing that happened. I don't know what it was from, but it happened to me as well. So they spent a lot of time asking me a bunch of questions. And I think the funniest time that I had was when they had me in that black ops thing, that sort of, and they decided to ask me about looking at Google Earth, at the maps. And whether when you're looking at Google Maps and the apps, if you could see three-dimensionally some of these serpents or some of these other sort of images that they thought they could tease out from those. And I said, that's a bunch of crap. There's nothing you're not seeing anything here except you're doing pareidolia. You're making up, you know, things that don't exist just because your mind has visibly, you know, done this.
Yeah.
And then in the midst of this whole conversation, I would go, hey, hold up, gentlemen. This is a bunch of baloney. And they thought that was hilarious. Says, who is this guy? Where do you come from? And say, can you say that again? Sit down and say that again. We have to get that on film. We didn't get that on film.
Yeah. Well, I got to say, as we wrap up this segment, it is interesting when you were mentioning the near the geoglyph and then, you know, comparing what you were seeing there with the landscape. Just looking on a satellite image of this area just north of Skinwalker Ranch, I don't think I've looked at a lot of satellite images in places where we're working and I've worked in that area. I don't think I've ever seen such obviously snake-like, like basalt trails almost in these. Yeah. It is so phenomenal. It's crazy. It's like a river of basalt.
Yes.
And then other sediment was probably placed around it, but that's all since eroded.
Right.
And all you're left with are these crazy snake-like things that are projecting out. That is so crazy.
And maybe we could talk a little more about what the snake means to Native people, because it's, unless you understand the nature of animism, totemism, mm-hmm. and shamanism, you're never going to understand or conceptualize what these features, these landforms, and even the images that are made in Native American art, both on paintings and on petroglyphs, have embedded in them in this multifaceted, multivalent conceptualizations.
That's awesome. All right. And just to note, I can see the helicopter pad, and the helicopter was not in residence when the satellite went over.
Woohoo!
All right. Well, let's take our final break and come back and talk a little bit more about Skinwalker Ranch here. Back in a minute. Welcome back to episode 43, the final segment of the Art Rock Art podcast, the Skinwalker Ranch edition, behind the scenes of the world famous History Channel show.
two million visitors to the show each episode, with Dr. Alan Garfinkel looking at the rock art and riffing on the symbolism and conceptualization of the universe that is emblazoned or memorialized in the rock art and in the rock features found at Skinwalker Ranch.
I mean, if the History Channel just could have given us like one penny for every person that watched that show,
we'd be done.
So, all right. Well, let's talk a little bit more about Skinwalker Ranch. So you mentioned seeing the cairn and the geoglyph there and the snakes, like we mentioned at the end, not the snakes, but the actual basalt flows. What else is on this ranch? And along those lines, you know, what were some of the conclusions that the show was trying to come to?
I think they brought me in because they wanted an independent scientific opinion on the rock art and on the geoglyph. They knew they were there, but they didn't know if they were aboriginal. They didn't know if they were authentic.
Created by a billionaire.
Right. Or if they were of recent historic repute. And they weren't.
Sure.
They were ancient. There was also a boxed cross that appears on one of the rocks. And of course, that's one of the classic symbols cross-culturally, but especially in the American Southwest, in the Desert West, and in Mesoamerica, that represent the heart and soul of the theology of Native Americans. So this box cross, in part, is seen as a deity. It's also representing Venus. It's called the Morning Star and the Evening Star. It also represents a symbol of resurrection, because as we see the sun and Venus go down, it comes back up again the next day. And so it's renewal and resurrection. Also, it's a 4 and 5. So it represents the cardinal directions. It represents earth, wind, and fire, the basic elements seen as, you know, the elements of the universe. Also, the central point, it's a deity. It's a god. It's a universal heart of creation that enjoins or connects or tethers all living things. One of the creation stories of the Uto Aztecans has to do with the four corners of the universe and these pillar-like individuals that are holding up the universe, with the fifth one being sort of the central nexus. So that's all emblazoned in this one symbol, which is this sort of inscribed cross. You see them in the Southwest, you see them in the Mojave. It's one of the archetypical signs for the grapevine style of rock art. It was done by the Mojave Indians. Those were the ones that were the agriculturalists that lived on the river. You also see it extensively in Pueblo and Utah territory. And you see it in the Cosos. Many different inscribed and circled crosses are readily apparent, embedded in or independent. They're also associated with fertility, reproductive symbolism, showing life being generated from them or associated with them.
Okay.
So there's that symbol as well. Again, it would make sense to tether such a symbol with an area of tremendous power and both visibly and invisibly.
So why is this called Skinwalker Ranch? Where does that come from?
This isn't the
habits of an eccentric billionaire, is it?
There's a being that's supposed to be a malevolent being, and I believe it's in the Navajo sacred narrative mythology called the Skinwalker. And the Skinwalker, I believe, is one of those beings that picks up the bad children and takes them away and, harms them and eats them up in his lair. So this is a cross-cultural symbol, a skinwalker, some sort of malevolent being that is, part insect and part human, and one that walks along the ground and walks along, your skin and can get you during the night and kill you.
Hmm.
So Skinwalker is a good name for the ranch because it's been such a prominent place for the supernatural.
Okay. Do you know who named it? Was it named by the guy who has the property there, or was it known as that beforehand by the native?
It's known as that beforehand. It was given that name from native people, I'm sure, who trafficked in that area. And it's not looked as a good place to go. It has bad mojo, and people stay out of that place because they're scared of it. They think that there's a malevolent force, something that's supernatural, that's not understandable, that exists there. And for some reason, it is a magnet for all of these supernatural, otherworldly expressions. And they're supposedly not good otherworldly, but bad.
Hmm. So back to the show production real quick. I'm curious, were they trying to answer any specific questions, or was it the typical generic, like, who built this and why and what can we learn about them kind of thing?
You know what I found? That was the best thing that they did. They only took 5 minutes out of my lengthy diatribe, and they tried to encapsulate just one key element of it. And they wanted to align with the broader theme of the entire show, but they did it authentically. They didn't misrepresent what I had to say. They were cogent in teasing out the most critical elements of what I had to say and boiling it down to a 5-minute soundbite. So I have to take my hat off to them because, you hear about how, you have these people come and they misrepresent, they pull from here and they pull from there. And it's so easy to get a some sort of a yellow journalism, as they called it, or some sort of a mangled communication that doesn't authentically align with what the individual was trying to portray. They did not do that at all. They took the essence of what I had to say and communicated it to their audience. So that was quite a blessing, and I was very impressed with the professionalism and sophistication of the show.
Wow. Okay. So given this experience, even with the ridiculous liability form and everything, if somebody called again, whether it's these producers or otherwise, would you be a little more, a little less leery of it, I guess, at first, and a little more willing to participate?
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah, I think I would. And I'm not one to disdain or minimize the supernatural. You're talking to someone who loves, what do I call them? Radical miracles. When God steps into history and does things that are so incontrovertibly supernatural and miraculous.
Yeah.
I love that. And so I don't believe there's a difference between science and religion, or even the study of the supernatural and the natural, because certainly I think my life has been dedicated to that, in studying shamanism, animism, totemism, and understanding the nature of indigenous religion. And I think that instead of some of this being rather silly, I think it has an insight and a wisdom into the real nature of our universe. And I think as physicists and astronomers and others begin to probe those depths, I think they're going to find again and again that much of the basic cosmological metaphors that native people had were bang on. Does that make any sense?
It does entirely. And I'm kind of on the opposite end of that spectrum, right? Like, I wasn't raised religious. I'm not religious now. But that being said, you have to learn about these things and understand these things to put yourself in the frame of mind of the people that created this stuff and did believe these things. I mean, if I were to take a modern example, if I wanted to study Catholic Church relics and practices and things like that, I'd have to learn about the Catholic Church in order to do that. You can't just shut that off and say, well, I don't believe in supernaturalism and shamanism and stuff personally. Therefore, I'm going to say this. If you want to understand how these things were created, you have to put yourself in the minds of the creators, and the minds of the creators believe these things. So you have to be open-minded and study about it and learn about it, to be honest, in order to be a good scientist.
And also scientists that have now studied shamanism and altered mm-hmm. states of consciousness and the use of various ethnobotanicals are finding that it transforms one's life and helps heals them both psychologically and physiologically. And there's a reason that throughout the world we have something called shamanism.
Yeah. Well, I would like to have been in that grant committee hearing for that first anthropologist that went to them and said, listen, I got to eat all these plants over here in order to really understand this.
Exactly.
Give me $10,000.
Yeah. That wouldn't have gone over well.
But people have done it. And honestly, again, I have not ever really taken any drugs. But if I studied that, if that's the culture I was studying, and if that's the thing I was doing, and it was safe and in a controlled environment and things like that, I would actually consider it in the name of science to understand, you know, what is really happening and what's going on. Again, you want to be safe and controlled as good science is, but you got to experience stuff like that sometimes in order to really get it. So,
well, there's a thing called near-death experiences, NDEs or NDOs.
Yeah.
And when scientists have studied that, they find that there's a common pattern. And as these people have touched the supernatural and connected with the divine, their life changes radically in a very positive way. And they're no mm-hmm. longer in fear of death. And in fact, understand or appreciate more of the essence and vitality of life.
Mm.
And
nice.
And I've been, you know, that's another, anything that's marginal or sort of, you know, eccentric, that's my specialty.
Right.
And I've made that a life's work. I think that's why I got into anthropology, because it seemed so different and unusual. It was the 1960s and people were experiencing the alternatives and the wonder of diversity.
Well, anthropology is literally the study of humans. And I'll tell you what, there is no shortage of topics because humans are constantly doing wacky things.
Exactly.
Yeah.
And I think that anthropology attracts some of the most eccentric and unusual people you can possibly find, because they're allowed to see others through their own eyes and appreciate the variability in the way people practice and fulfill their lives.
Right. All right.
All right.
Well, with that note, I think we'll go ahead and end that here. I will try to find some good links so you guys can link straight over to the Skinwalker Ranch episode on the History Channel and watch that. And Alan's contact information is in there, so you can, you know, hit him up if you want to talk about it. And yeah, I think this was a great episode, and it's nice hearing behind the scenes in sort of a candid way and also learning about something new. So I wish there were more shows like this that were focused on topics like this and presented in this way. I mean, I know these guys are doing a pretty good job on this show, but we could always use more because there's so much to talk about out there.
Well, next show will be the History Channel, the rock art world.
That's right.
The world of rock art.
According to Alan.
Yes. Adventures of Dr. Alan Garfinkel as he prowls the world, discovering new and mysterious rock art.
Man. That'd be a good show. All right.
God bless you, Chris Webster. See y'all on the flip-flop. Bye-bye.
Thanks for listening to the Rock Art Podcast with Dr. Alan Garfinkel and Chris Webster. You can find this podcast on the educational podcast app Lyceum, Lyceum, and wherever you find podcasts. Find show notes and contact information at www.arcpodnet.com/rockart. Thanks for listening, and thanks for sharing this podcast with your family and friends. This episode was produced by Chris Webster from his RV Traveling America, Tristan Boyle in Scotland, and the Archaeology Podcast Network, and was edited by Chris Webster.
This has been a presentation of the Archaeology Podcast Network. Visit us on the web for show notes and other podcasts at www.archpodnet.com. Contact us at chris@archaeologypodcastnetwork.com.